Welcome to the Ian Bousfield Experience. I'm glad you're here. This series of podcasts are just things that come up in my mind when I'm thinking about playing, when I'm thinking about teaching, and general thoughts about music. There's some things here that I hope you'll find really useful. And don't forget, if you've got any comments or if there's anything you want to discuss further, go to ianbousfield.com. Hello. Time for a really positive, bright, fun podcast. And firstly, apologies for the sound in the background. The Swiss Air Force seemed to be patrolling Bern city centre with helicopters this morning. There must be something happening. Again, following on from all of these amazing questions that came in, some of them were require a different type of podcast, I think. Joris and John Hinckley want me to talk about Burgundy, and you guys have pushed me over the edge. I'm going to do a wine podcast. I keep threatening to do it. I am going to do it, but I'm going to keep it off this site. It might be on my own community, but I'm going to, you know, spend more time talking about wine. Dirk Amrein, very fine trombone player, wants me to talk about beer. It would appear that I have quite a reputation. I would like to say at this point that I do enjoy fine wines and enjoy brewing beer. But I would like to stress that I love not drinking just as much. I'll do a podcast on those things. I think I'm going to do it. It'll be fun. But Igor Rankovic, you wanted me to talk about difficult conductors. How long do you expect this podcast to be, Igor? So that's it, probably. My stories about conductors will have to go on a podcast all of its own, perhaps at a time when some more of them have sadly passed away, because I think the stories that I would tell, that they know where I live, they'd come and get me. So I have to be careful. I am, however, you're going to start with an issue that's been raised by someone who is quite definitely not a difficult conductor. Leo McFall was the associate conductor in the Gustav Mahler Jugend Orchestra, in our beautiful family there. And as with everything in that orchestra, you make friends for life. Leo is a remarkable young man who manages to balance at a very high level getting the job done, yet remaining totally respectful and being a gentleman. We just had an interesting discussion because he was going to conduct Schubert 9, we call it. The Great Sea Monster is what we used to call it in Manchester. And I mentioned something that I think tickled him, which was that Niklaus Harnoncourt, the great Niklaus Harnoncourt, the founder of Original Instrument Performance, yes, sorry to break it to you, Roger Norrington, John Elliott Gardner, they were not the first. They were following on in the footsteps of Niklaus Harnoncourt, who, by the way, said Original Instrument Performance was invented in my living room in Graz in 1954. But that's the theme of another podcast all in itself. I never found him to be a very good conductor in the strict sense of the terms, you know, conductor. He could not get anything together. Bless him. His actual technique was not great. But he said something in every rehearsal that I will use in every lesson that I give ever. Every rehearsal that he did was a privilege to sit through. It was a lecture, and it's only years later that you realize the incredible learning opportunity it was just to actually sit and listen to him speak. I remember one time just sort of like firing a question at him, and said, "Are you walking past?" And I said, "Wagenseil trombone concerto, tenor or alto?" He said, "Tenor, and I've got the exact one at home." So There's a lot more work goes into being a conductor than I think many of us realize. So anyway, Leo was tickled by this thing that where Niklas Harnoncourt had said, there is no such thing as a 16th in music, or an 8th. So for the English, let me translate that into, that's quavers and semi-quavers, or in other words, semi-quavers and quavers. Most of the world call a quaver an 8th. A semi-quaver, a 16th. And if you look at it on a mathematical point like that, you know, what we were talking about was the trombones. With not 1/8 or 16th was sung there. To try and get away from the bum be bum 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 ba, because it's so often as bum 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 bum. Because unfortunately, no, not unfortunately, the great Pierre Boulez taught the world to subdivide. Before then, I think all of these rhythms were a matter of negotiation, depending on the musical context. And so that's, so Leo wanted to talk about that. Just next time you're playing, you know, if you don't subdivide and play vertically in a score in the Rite of Spring, or even arguably from about 1920 onwards, you've got a train wreck. I once heard an orchestra fall to pieces on Brahms 1, you know, the bit, beep bum, bum bum, beep bum, bum bum. Because half the orchestra were doing that, and the others were going, bum bum, bum bum, bum bum, bum. Yeah, I'm not going to say where it was. Wonderful orchestra, by the way. And it's not one of the ones that I used to play with. If you're playing romantic repertoire, you know, it's like, I'll give you a really good example, Mahler 5. And I shudder at what we used to do when I was in the London Symphony. You know, that beam, beam, bum, bum, beam, beam, bum, bum. And it's sterile. You know, beam, beam, bum, bum, beam, beam, bum, bum, bum. Now, if you wish to say that that's not what's written, that's not what I mean, please feel free to turn off this podcast now. But we have to, you know, you get this thing called an optical illusion. We have to create an oral, illusion sometimes. Like when we play Scheherazade. Ding, ta-dum, ta-da-da-da-dum, 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 ta-da. That's not a bloody 16th, I'll tell you. But if sometimes, if you play a 16th, dum, ta-da, ya-da-da-da-da, ding, ta-dum, ta-da-da-da, ding, ta-dum, ta-da-da-da-dum, ta-da-da-da. It's just so limp, isn't it? It's so lame. There has to be a reason. I bet you Rimsky-Korsakov was not subdividing that. I bet you had, dun, da, 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 dun, da, da. I bet you that's where rhythm was at the point that he wrote that music. So I guess that's the first question I wanted to. It's a lovely subject that Leo's raised there. And for any of you who have not played for him yet, I hope you get the chance soon. Now the next question tickled me. He's so funny, you'll imagine why. It's from Ian Craddock. I'm going to tell you about Ian Craddock. Ian Craddock was the solo euphonium player in the Yorkshire Imperial Band when I joined when I was 14 years old, and I sat behind him. And he was and still remains an incredibly gentle soul and an absolute gentleman. A rose amongst thorns at the time, one could possibly say. And he's probably not going to be on your radar. I mean, first of all, he stopped playing brass bands a long time ago, but he's probably not going to be on your radar as being perhaps one of the glorious, glowing greats of the euphonium or the tuba and euphonium world. And there's a reason for that. Ian was one of those rare people who was an excellent player, but he was a team player. And he would look at his balance in the chord and see where he needed to be, and he never stuck out. Historically, he's also very important because the Philip Spark Euphonium Concerto was written for him, or whatever it's called. I played on that recording, I was 14, 15, was it Ossett Town Hall or something like that. Played beautifully. He's written in, and you can hear why I thought it was funny. I can imagine balance is difficult in the orchestral world. Ian, seriously? I tell you what, I should have had a sideline as a palm reader. I spent 30 years looking at the palm of most conductors' hands. You know, guide to conducting. When the big shiny thing comes up with a back behind up, tell them to shut up. Maurice Murphy actually once looked at, was it George Hurst's score when he was in the BBC Northern, now the BBC Philharmonic, and he found it written in his score, tell trombones they're too loud. So yeah, Ian, you have no idea. You have no idea. So you can imagine the balance is difficult in the orchestral world. Yes. I.e. all brass sections. Naturally, you would dictate to trombones. What about the horns, trumpets? You're near the trumpets, but horns would also require a shout. He also said he remembers me coming to Yorkshire Imperial. 14-year-old boy, folks. He remembers me coming to Yorkshire Imperial, and immediately they had to have a meeting with the baritones and the horns to agree that they were going to play one level up whenever I was playing. Oh, no. 14, really? Goodness me. And he did the same with the basses to try and get a lead tuba sound. None of the conductors ever complained. In fact, Peter Parks was very complimentary. Ian, there's so much great stuff in here. And what you can relate to brass bands, you can relate to any situation. What you're talking about there is you're changing the role, you know? And maybe that's where I got it from. Maybe, Ian, you were a big influence. If you go back to how the traditional brass band sound, and we can translate this into orchestra. Orchestra sound was based. It's based on the pyramid thing. So you've got the balance, you've got the basses in a brass band, or the double basses in an orchestra, creating a huge foundation. Everything above that should get quieter till almost like the cornet section or the first violins in chordal balance are just like a harmonic of the chord, rather than, unless you've got the melody, of course. So that historically has always been the balance that I have worked on, and maybe I did get it from brass bands. There was a very legendary brass band composer conductor called Roy Newsom, and I asked him about it when I was 14 or 15. How did you get that special Black Dyke sound? You see, folks, I guess looking back on it, you see why some people are successful. I was 14 or 15 and I asked him how he was getting the sound out of the band. I think if a 14 or 15 year old ever went to, I don't know, David King or somebody like that and said I think he'd be shocked, you know, that a 14 or 15 year old would show such initiative. Anyway, and I was going to Peter Parks and asking the same sort of things. Now, and he said, because Roy was an organist, that was his philosophy. He created that kind of Black Dyke sound by replicating an organ, you know, with this huge bass sound, and then building everything on top of that. But what you're talking about here, Ian, is not just balance. You're talking about changing roles. So when you're playing with the basses, you're basically the first. It's like the cellos fitting into the bass sound. If you're playing with the horns, then you're going to mold your sound into that. And what you're talking about is an incredibly flexible approach. I think, sadly, in the brass band world, although many brass bands sound similar to how they used to, that philosophy has gone a little bit, because simply bass sections cannot make this huge, soft, wonderful, warm, round sound that's big enough to compete with the terrorists who now play the cornet, because it's so powerful. And if you translate that into an orchestra, with the Vienna Philharmonic double basses, first of all, they are the hooligans. They make so much noise, it's scary. If you ever wondered why the brass doesn't sound as loud in the Vienna Philharmonic as perhaps the London Symphony, let me assure you, they are playing as loud. It's just they have no chance to get through the string sound. It is astonishing. The last time I played there, the orchestra got younger, the strings were stronger, I literally felt there was a wall between me and the audience that I just could not penetrate because they're making so much noise. And you've got the double basses behind you just sort of like trampling you down because they have so much power without the aggression, just this really strength of sound. So, yeah, I think, Ian, my philosophy is of balance has always been the pyramid, starting at the bottom, and also to change the role. You know, if I'm sitting next to a Maurice Murphy or a Hans Gansch or something like that, I'm going to adapt my sound to be like fourth trumpet or whatever, you know, fifth trumpet or bass trumpet. If I'm going to play with a horn player, well then perhaps I might actually go the other way and make a bit of more of a podgy sort of rounder sound to give them something to sit on, you know? So it depends what you're doing. If I'm playing with the cellos, I'm going to adapt my sound to that. So this all kind of moved away from, you know, this, you know, always making your best sound. You must always make your best sound for the situation you're in. And the balance, if one person is sticking out, if that pyramid is broken, then a chord will not balance. And and any ensemble will not sound homogenous. Ian, you're a beauty. Thanks for your question. Keep well. Ralph Ridier has written, Ralph is a great campaigner for musical education in the UK, and boy, do we need people like that. Congratulations on everything you're doing. This is a very short question. What is greatness in musicians? Great and genius are words that are bandied about. What is greatness? Well, I think what is greatness in a human being? I think it's more important. I was recently very kindly informed by the general manager of the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra that Wolfgang Böttcher, formerly principal cello of the Berlin Philharmonic, had passed away at the age of 86. And I took some quiet moments to think about the times I'd had with him and to wonder at the life that he'd lived. And apart from being one of the legendary cellists of the last 86 years, or 83 years, however old he was when he started playing, he was one of the most remarkable human beings that I'd ever met. And I think the two tend to go hand in hand. So the first of all, it's the human qualities of somebody. I would say, if you look at someone like Carlo Maria von Giulini, and look at the way that man lived his life with integrity, as opposed to someone like George Zell or Fritz Reiner, where if you find a photo of those buggers smiling, I think, you know, you might actually just be wind. Might be gripe. So I think greatness starts with the person, with having great personal qualities. What I miss about Wolfgang, what I miss about Maurice Murphy is who they were, not what they did, really. I felt privileged to know them as people. I am privileged every time someone like Michael Tilson Thomas sits down and takes half an hour out of his life to have a coffee with me and changes my world again. I was privileged to talk to people like George Schulte, Valery Gergiev, Pierre Boulez, you name it. And it was a privilege. It was an absolute privilege. And they're not just musicians. They're not just conductors. They're great people. But as the actual, I think, nuts and bolts of your question, Ralph, I think this matter of genius, and it's something that I base my teaching around, is genius is not something that we have or somebody has. It's something that somebody can access. It's like this life source of genius that makes what we do so addictive and so wonderful. And Franz Welsermost once hinted at it in this way. He said to me, once you use the word I, or I think, you're wrong. It's not about you, it's not about me, it's about the music. And once we let this pathetic human make its decisions as to what I think is the best, what I prefer, what I like, rather than what is this, how do I let this, as Pierre Boulez said to me, we are only, how you say, a conduit. Because I had a conversation, I said, look, I asked the question I think a lot of people would want to ask. You don't look like you're doing anything. How do you do it? I nearly cried in the concert last night. How are you doing that? And that was his answer. We are only a conduit to allow the music to pass through us. We don't do it. We put ourselves in a position where we can access this stream of what he didn't say this bit. This is my words. These are my words. We allow greatness to pass through us, and it's a privileged position to be in. We are not the great ones. This stream of greatness is what is great. And so I guess I've probably said enough. You know, some of us, and I count myself as being very fortunate, very occasionally genius passes through me. I am not a genius. Very occasionally I can put myself in a position in a concert. And somehow it seems to need to be in the live environment of a concert. It's something about that human interaction with the people around you. On occasion in my life, genius has passed through me. It's not something that I have on tap. It's not something that I can access on a regular basis. And I can't say I can guarantee to be able to do it to order. I can't. It's their special moments. And I guess it's what is going to keep me addicted to music. And being a musician, like I said in the previous podcast, as long as I have air to breathe. There are a couple of people I would mention. Rostropovich on the cello. Seemed to be able to do it to order. It's almost like he was living. He was living in that place. And he could access it. That's why he's one of the greatest performers in the history of music. And he almost seemed to know what he was doing. Luciano Pavarotti thought he knew what he was doing, but he didn't. It's a little bit, in the case of someone like Pavarotti, or indeed like Maurice Murphy, the great Maurice Murphy. And I would put them in the same category, actually. Have you ever played football or table tennis, and when you're least expecting, you're not even thinking, and it's going to happen once in your life, the ball will come over your shoulder. You look at it, you swing your foot, and it goes straight into the top corner of the goal 30 yards away. And no, anybody who ever played in a competitive match with me, no, you will testify that I never did that in a match. No, I did. Actually, I did. I scored from the halfway line once. It was a terrible cross. And it's like, wait a minute, what happened? How did I do that? And then you try and repeat that for the rest of your life. It's never going to happen. Unconsciously, you accessed the genius around you. There was something that could calculate the speed of the ball coming to you, the angle it was coming to you, what speed you needed to swing your foot. And he did that all without you thinking, which is why I am not a fan of the word interpretation. Because that involves the useless human brain. Yeah, come on, send all the comments. I'm all wrong. Yeah, I know, fine. It's my podcast. If I want to say it, I'll say it. I said it. There you go. And if you look at someone like a Pavarotti, I'm not sure how much there was really in the most amazing things. I'm not sure there was much of a thought process going on. It was just something that was passing through him. So, Ralph, what's greatness in musicians? That's my best stab at answering, but it's a good question. The short questions are good. Leonard from Canada, my friend, very fine young trombone player. I've seen him at Domaine Forger. Has written an interesting question. What specific characteristics make a brass sonority dark or bright? And in what musical situations is it better to play darker or brighter? Okay. Now, for any of you who have ever had a relationship with anyone, you will know that at some point you say, I'm sorry, you're not listening to what I'm saying. You don't understand a single word I've just said. We're speaking the same language, but you don't understand me. We all know that, don't we? Communicating using words is useless. As anyone will know from the gaffes that I make on here. Some I catch, some I don't. Some I realise I'm saying, some I don't. It's very difficult to translate a feeling and a thought into sound. And words are not great, but they're the best we've got. So again, Leonard, first of all, if I was putting my lawyer hat on, I'd say, what do you mean by dark or bright? But I guess that's what you are asking, isn't it? We're identifying what is dark and what is bright. Oh. So the words dark and bright will mean different things to different people. That's what I'm saying. In many areas of the brass world, dark has taken the word sort of on the role of good, and bright has taken on the role of aggressive or nasty. And so I think it's very confusing. I don't ever tell my students to make a dark sound or a bright sound. I always tell them to try and create the sound that's appropriate for the music that they're playing. You can think of happy, you can think of emotions. I prefer to think of emotions. I hear a lot of people who purport to be making a dark sound, and because of the way they've heard the word, the sound is dead, it's not resonating. And I hear a lot of people who use the word bright for meaning there's no substance to the sound. So, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, okay, let me do as I always do. I'm going to make two parallels here. One is to a violin, string instrument. I'll make several parallels. To a voice. To a great voice. To a great wine. To a great Burgundy. Which I think embodies this more than a great Bordeaux. Not that I would turn either down. It's everything contained in one note that a great virtuoso or a great sip of a great wine. It's everything. It'll tell you its life story. It's bright, it's dark, it's fresh, it's old, it's young, it's spicy, it's fruity. The voice is just the vehicle for this emotion that is just like, I remember my mate in Vienna saying, could you come into the Brahms Saal and listen to some violins for me? And he said, I'm trying some new ones out. And it was like, he played the sort of beginning of, in the Brahms Saal in the Musikverein in Vienna. He came and he played the beginning of the Sibelius Violin Concerto on four different instruments. And, you know, it's like, good. And then he played one and I started getting tearful. I keep saying that on these podcasts, don't I? I started getting kind of emotional. I said, what's that? And he said, well, here, you try it. I said, well, I can't play a violin. And he said, no, come on, you have a good, just pull the bow across the string. This is how, off you go. And it's like, wow, this thing was like alive in my hands, you know? And he said, well, this one is 300,000, this one is 700,000, and so on. He said, and that one that you like is a 3 million Stradivarius I've just borrowed for the morning. And it was everything. So, Lenach, I'm going around your question a little bit, but to say we should make a dark sound is so bloody one-dimensional and so bloody primitive. Sorry. It can't just be dark. I think we can think of an audio balancing system where you've got everything from the bass to the treble. You know, you can maybe in certain, but that's a little bit manufactured, isn't it? You know, music needs to be more creative, more imaginative. To kind of like say, well, I'm going to turn the treble down on the sound, I just lift the bass up a little bit. I'm thinking of when I play Mahler 3, you know, where, you know, if I come in on that first note, you could, I guess, analyze the, you know, is it more trebly, is it more bassy, is it, you know, what is it? And then, of course, let's not close out the quality issue. Is it a good sound? Above dark and bright, good is, I would say, if we're going to use another word, is more important. What's the quality of the sound? Dudley Bright, former principal trombone in the London Symphony, my successor, I think he had a very interesting sound because he has one of the finest sounds that has ever been made on a trombone, without question. But it seems to me that no one ever heard on recordings, I don't think recordings could really pick up the true magnitude of the quality of his sound. Because when you hear it live, it's dark and it's bright and it's everything, you know. But I don't think he's ever been done justice on a recording. Maybe someone could do something about that. Because I think anyone who hears him live realizes, wow, this is an amazing sound. So what is the sound for Mahler 3? Well, Leonard, it's the sound for Mahler 3, isn't it? Once you get to the point of saying it should be darker, maybe the two words that we should be using is it should be more appropriate to Mahler 3 and it should be better quality. I'm not meaning in your case because I haven't heard you play, but I'm just going around your question. What musical situation? Now, okay, I've gone that far. Now I'm going to go with you. Okay, because I know the conventional understanding of the words dark and bright. So what situation is it better to play darker or brighter? Okay, dark. Bruckner Symphony number 1, the big chorale in the middle of the first movement. Bim, bam, beep, beep, whoa. Bim, bam, bop, beep. And by the way, work out what that rhythm was. It is just what it is. And that's the darker. Shostakovich, First Symphony. End of the whole piece. Teeth, biting, fire. Bright. So they're two very, very obvious different situations. But, and here's the big but in all of this. I've heard people making, in inverted commas, a bright sound. And the further away you go from it, the less you can hear it. Until I've heard some very famous trombone players in a concert hall, and it's almost pitchless. You can't actually, all you can use is going. And so that's not a bright sound. That's not a bright sound. The problem with us, Leonard, as trombone players is we all choose instruments standing behind them, and we all judge each other sitting next to each other. We very, very, very rarely have a colleague go out in the concert hall in a concert to say, yeah, I couldn't really hear you. You know, one of the, I love coaching in the summer in Kusatsu, in the hot spring area of Japan. Coaching, I do a bit of teaching. It's mainly I play a concerto every two days with the Gunma Symphony, which is great. I love it. I love it there, and I'm hoping to get back there at some point. And I teach in the mornings, a couple of hours, and this classroom up in the mountains. And it's a winter ski area. In the summer, people go walking. And we have this discussion, and I get everyone to give me the description of the trombone sound. You know, what's it? Noble, dark, rich, warm, strong, powerful. And they said, right, now let's all go outside, and one by one, you're all going to go up to the top of that hill there, and we're going to stand 50 yards away from you, and you're all going to play Mahler 3. And a look of horror as I say, okay, guys, what are you hearing now? It's kind of like direct, aggressive. There isn't much sound with it. I said, how noble is it? How elegant? Well, not really, is it? So there are so many different aspects around bright, dark in relation to musical settings and to the quality as well. So Leonard, I'm not answering your question, and I'll tell you why. Well, I'm answering it in this way. Open your mind to the musical appropriateness of what you're about to play, rather than sort of like just trying to manufacture what you think should be bright or should be dark. I think I really enjoyed doing this. I think that's enough for this podcast. There are more questions that are brilliant. I'm going to get more technical in the next one. Hope you enjoy this. Keep listening. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. If there are any issues that you found particularly interesting, don't forget to contact me, and always go to ianbousfield.com for lots more interesting stuff.